morning. We're delighted to see you all, but especially students who are here with our Portland class program. Would the students from Madison Central Montessori please stand so we can greet you? We're delighted to see you. You may be seated. Students from Marathon High School, would they stand? We're delighted to see you also. And the teachers. Students from Faith Christian School, would they stand, please? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. How about Deerfield High School? Are they here? What? No. Oh, I'm sorry. We've been expecting someone from Deerfield High School earlier this morning, and then I thought perhaps we get. Is there a school group that I have not introduced? But the students are here with a program cleverly entitled Portland Class. And students from around the state are invited to come to the Supreme Court, listen to an oral argument, and then meet with a justice after this second oral argument. And if the students accept the invitation, then they are sent materials about the case that they will hear. And this is a national award-winning program to not only teach the students about the judicial system, but an opportunity to read, write, and analyze legal materials. If anyone would like a copy of the summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, we will give you a summary. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And he is the justice with whom you will meet after this case is concluded. Next to Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Wilkinsack. And next to her is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions completed, we will now hear our second case, 07AP385, Harold Umansky versus ABC Insurance Company. Arguing for the defendant and petitioner, Barry Fox, is John J. Grinsky. Mr. Grinsky.
May it please the court, my name is John Glinsky, and I represent the petitioner Barry Fox. This is a wrongful death action brought by the parents and estate of Richard Umansky, an employee of ABC Sports.
Excuse me, counsel, could you do something to either pull the microphone toward you or tilt it a little better? I'm having trouble hearing you this morning.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's okay. Much better. Thank you.
A wrongful death action brought by the parents and estate of Richard Umansky, an employee of ABC Sports, against Barry Fox, Director of Facilities at Camp Randall Stadium, for an incident that occurred on November 21st, 2003, when Mr. Umansky fell to his death from a camera platform at Camp Randall Stadium. The Umansky's contention is that Fox violated a ministerial duty because his job description required compliance with applicable safety codes, and 29 CFR Section 1910.23C1 incorporated by the Wisconsin Administrative Code, Sections Commerce 32.15 and 32.50, required railings on platforms. The Court of Appeals agreed with the Manskys, quote, if Fox's employer, i.e. the state, was required by state law to comply with this regulation as to this platform, unquote. The first error committed by the Court of Appeals is in not ruling based on the undisputed facts that the state was not required to comply with this regulation. The state was not required to comply because there was no duty to private employees or frequenters, which Mr. Umansky was, under Commerce 32.15 and 32.50.
Mr. Glinsky, if I can interrupt you for a minute. My understanding is what the Court of Appeals did here was they sent this matter back to the trial court. They said they didn't have enough information to determine whether or not this was a ministerial duty situation, and therefore they felt that the facts had to be further developed. I take it you disagree with that?
That's correct, Your Honor. Because what the Court of Appeals held is that the case should be remanded for fact-finding with respect to whether this platform was ever used by state employees, therefore making it a workspace under OSHA, and therefore qualifying as a platform by definition. But that is really irrelevant. It's also inconsistent because what they're saying is that we have to determine whether public employees use it to determine whether the code applies, but if it does, then the state, and by delegation, Mr. Fox, is responsible to private employees, Mr. Umansky. So it seems to me there's an inconsistency there. The relevant statute is Section 101.055, entitled Public Employee Safety and Health. And paragraph 1 reads, it is the intent of this section to give employees of the state, of any agency and of any political subdivision of this state, rights and protections relating to occupational safety and health equivalent to those granted to employees in the private sector under OSHA. Paragraph 3 reads, the department, meaning the Department of Commerce, shall adopt by administrative rule, which they did with 3215 and 3250, standards to protect the safety and health of public employees. The standards shall provide protection at least equal to that provided to private sector employees under standards promulgated by OSHA. Now, if you look at Commerce 32, you'll see that those standards, the OSHA standards, have been incorporated in 3250, which reads, Section 101.055-3A stats permits the department to incorporate by reference the standards adopted in Table 3250-1, and that table incorporates, among other provisions, 29 CFR 1910. Commerce 32001 indicates the purpose of the chapter, stating this chapter establishes minimum occupational safety and health standards for public employees. It's axiomatic that agencies have only authority that is expressly granted or necessarily implied by the statute giving them the authority. There is nothing in 101.055 that expressly grants or necessarily implies that the Commerce Department was authorized to adopt standards applicable to private employees or frequenters, or to make public employers, much less public employees, liable to private employees and frequenters for a violation of those standards. It's undisputed that Richard Umansky was not a public employee. In fact, it alleges that he was a private employee because he was an employee of ABC Sports. It's also undisputed that no public employee was using the platform at the time Mr. Umansky fell to his death. Now this, I should mention, this would not make any difference as a practical matter, because even if public employees had been using the platform at the time Mr. Umansky fell, there would still be no duty on the part of the state that could be delegated to Fox that would run to Mr. Umansky, because he was a private employee. And any duty would not be delegable in any event. But if public employees had at least been using it at the time, which they weren't, then one could argue that 3215, 3250 was applicable and applied to the state. Still wouldn't run to Umansky, and it still couldn't be delegated because it's a safe place statute.
Mr. Umansky, let me ask you something that relates, I think, to what you've just been discussing. Let's say that you had two people on this platform. One was an employee of ABC Sports, and the other was an employee of UW. And they both fell to their death because there was no railing. Is it your position that only one of them could maintain an action, only the public employee, against Mr. Fox?
Well, yes, under Commerce 32, but presumably the private employee or the estate to parents, whatever, would sue his or her employer under OSHA. So there, it's not as if there would be...
Couldn't sue Mr. Fox, who is the director of facilities, if you will, for Camp Randall.
Correct. Because that right under Commerce 32 is a right given under the statute to public employees, not private employees. Their rights come under OSHA, federal law, by which they can sue their employer. And that's why ABC Sports was cited by OSHA and cited and given a penalty because they failed to comply with the applicable OSHA regulation.
Counselor,
it doesn't apply directly to the state.
Counselor, with the university being the employer of this hypothetical person that Justice Crooks poses, could the employee really sue Fox even though the university was his employer, or would workers' compensation be that employee's remedy?
Well, under the Safe Place statute, you can only sue the employer. But there would be a common law duty, a duty under the common law of ordinary care on the part of Fox towards that employee, presumably. But, of course, the problem there is that that's a discretionary duty, so immunity would apply. But so then you've got two duties. You've got a duty, a safe place statute that runs from the employer to an employee, and that cannot be delegated. Okay, so in this case, you would have it, the state would have, as the employer, the safe place duty, but that cannot be delegated to supervisory personnel, and the safe place statute doesn't apply to supervisory personnel. So the duty that any supervisory personnel would have to the person injured, the employee, at most would be ordinary care under the common law, which would be discretionary.
Right.
Because there's no similar common law provision equal to 1910.23(c)(1) indicating precisely what kind of railings have to be put on what kind of platforms.
Yeah, I guess my question just came up because of Justice Crooks's question, and I was concerned not with your analysis of these statutes, but the effect of workers' compensation, which applies to the state. If you got a state employee and they're falling off, I didn't think they could sue the state or a co-employee. I thought workers' compensation was their sole remedy.
Well, that's true, but there is a right under the common law against a negligent fellow employee, but you have to show that they committed an affirmative act which violated the common law duty of ordinary care, something over and above the duty they had to their employer as a supervisory employee.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm probably getting off the track.
Okay. Well, no, it's relevant, but you've got different standards that apply depending on the different relationships. The Court of Appeals actually failed to address this issue, even though it's a question of law and the facts are undisputed. The duties on public employers under Commerce 32 should not be extended to private employees or frequenters because safety statutes and rules are not to be extended beyond the legislative intent expressed in those statutes and rules. And there's nothing in the statute here or in the rules that indicates that the protection afforded is to be extended to private employees or frequenters. When the legislature has intended that someone be covered by the Safe Place statute, it has so indicated. For example, in Section 101.11, paren 1, the ordinary safe place statute provision that's cited, there is a duty specifically to provide a safe place of employment to employees and frequenters. Safe employment applies only to employees. When we're talking about safe place of employment, the legislature specifically extended that to frequenters. There is no such indication in 101.055 that there was ever an intent to extend this beyond public employees. There's also no need to extend it because private employees are protected under OSHA anyway, and can sue their private employers. The state's duty to Richard Umansky was not under Commerce 32, but under 101.11(1) of the statutes, and not to provide safe employment, because he wasn't a state's employee, but a safe place of employment because he was a frequenter. But as the Court of Appeals held in Spencer versus County of Brown, 101.01(1) imposes a discretionary duty, because the duty is to render the place of employment or public building as safe as the situation will reasonably permit, which obviously indicates that discretion is involved. Umansky's make two arguments. One is that it doesn't matter whether Richard Umansky was a public or private employee, and it doesn't matter whether public employees were using the platform at the time of the accident. All that matters is the nature of the building, because 3215 and 3250 read that it applies to, quote, all places of employment and public buildings of a public employer, unquote. That, of course, ignores the expressly stated purpose of 101.055, but also, as I indicated, the state, when it intended rights to be given to frequenters, it specifically stated that, as it did in 101.11. If the legislature had intended that 101.055 was to extend rights to private employees, it would have specifically said so, just as it did in 101.11.
Counsel, can I turn the focus to whether or not the activity involved constitutes a breach of ministerial duty?
Sure, that was going to be my third point, but we can jump to it.
Let's do it. Why not? Okay. I look at some of the cases. We've got a lot of cases. I was thinking about just citing the ones that I wrote, but maybe I'll be more generous than that, Phil. But they say things like that breach of ministerial duty has to be set forth in certain terms, leaving no ability for discretion as to time, mode, and operation. And I think of when I first got on this court, shortly after I got on the court, the case versus Kimps versus Hill was one of those cases. Then after that, Kavanaugh, a high-speed chase in Milwaukee was another case. And that's just kind of the boilerplate language. So compare the facts of this case with that kind of a standard, that standard being that the duty has to be certain and imperative, involving merely the performance of a specific task when the law imposes, prescribes, and defines the time, mode, and occasion for its performance with such certainty that nothing remains for judgment or discretion. Assuming that's the standard, how do you apply the facts to that standard?
Well, the argument, it depends on how you look at it. If you just take the job description and the requirement that you comply with safety codes, you really have a two-step analysis. Because the first thing that has to be done is you have to decide whether a particular rule or regulation is applicable. Then once you make that decision, then you have to decide what the rule requires. Now, the Court of Appeals focused only on the second element and said that 1910, was it 23C1, was specific in indicating that platforms must have certain types of railings, and those railings are described in OSHA. And that's a pretty decent argument. One of the arguments against it is that there's nothing in the job description that indicated how Mr. Fox was to go about ensuring such compliance or when he was to do it. So I think there is discretion there. But more important than that is the Court of Appeals ignored the first element here. And this court has held that the application of a rule to facts is a quasi-judicial decision. And that was never more true than in this case, because what Fox had to decide here was whether 32.15 and 3250 applied when It's intended to protect public employees. Rich Jumansky was not a public employee. No public employees were using the platform at the time. And OSHA provides a remedy for such an employee to sue their employer. That is a discretionary decision that Mr. Fox would have to have made, and he never made it. 1910.23C1 might be ministerial, arguably, if it applies. But determination of whether it applies is clearly discretionary. And there's no allegation, and certainly no evidence, that he ever determined that Section 1910.23C1 was applicable. In fact, it's undisputed that he did not decide that, because in the appendix of Jumansky's brief at page 77, what's quoted is, or what's back there is the deposition of Barry Fox. And on page 21 of that deposition, at line 21, the question that was asked was by Mr. Riley, "I may have asked this, and if I did, I apologize. Did the code in November 2003 require that a platform of this kind have some form of railing?" The answer by Mr. Fox was, "I don't know that." Had Mr. Fox made the decision that, yes, that provision applies, then I think he might be able to make a decent argument that there was a ministerial duty to comply with the regulation and put a railing up as it required. There are two railings, actually, one 42 inches and one intermediate railing, assuming you can get by the problem that they didn't indicate when he had to comply with it. But the other thing to remember is that Jumansky's had the burden of proof. There's no evidence, there's no allegation, in fact, it's undisputed that that determination was never made by Fox. To me, it's analogous to the situation in the cases involving highway signs, where this court has held it's discretionary, the determination whether to put up a sign. Once you put it up, you've got to follow the highway manual, because it's explicit. But here, the initial decision, the determination whether the regulation applied, was never made. So whether the regulation was ministerial or not, once you got to it, really is irrelevant, because the first step was never taken. It's as if no decision was ever made to put up a stop sign. So whether the stop sign would have complied with the manual is really irrelevant. So that was my third point. I don't know if that answers your close enough.
You're indicating that there is an OSHA remedy against the deceased private employer, is that right?
Well, actually, no, not now you mentioned. I'm thinking there's no private right of action in OSHA. So that is enforced by OSHA, by the Labor Department. So the action there would be citation and a fine for the employer for failing to comply. I believe that's right. So there wouldn't be a private cause of action in OSHA.
Is there any remedy for this gentleman's estate, other than the remedy being sought?
Well, you do have the claims board.
What about workers' comp, as was discussed before? Workers' comp with the wrongful death benefits.
Well, for the wrongful death action, yeah, that's true. You'd have the wrongful death action. Right. But there's no private cause of action under OSHA. With respect to Jumansky's, well, let me jump ahead here because my time is running out. The Court of Appeals, I think, made a mistake, at least in part, maybe mainly because they relied on Chart versus Dvorak. But that's not a safe place case. They stated they were not shifting liability to Fox, but in fact they did. They shifted safe place liability from Fox's employer to him, because the standard that's used to determine Fox's liability is the safe place standard. It's 1910, incorporated by Commerce 32. So this is not a common law duty of ordinary care. that was imposed on Fox. His liability is imposed for failure to follow the safe place statute, which couldn't be delegated. So the Court of Appeals said it wasn't doing that, but in fact it did. And before my time runs out, I want to point out something that is why it's important that the court correct this, because if you look at the latest version of the statutes, at the end of 101.11 with the notes, the second to the last note, it reads, when an employer delegates a statutory or regulatory duty to an employee, it does not thereby shift liability, although in this case they did. Rather, the employer is responsible if the employee fails to carry out that duty. When the state is the employer, the state is immune from suit for a monetary judgment under the doctrine of sovereign immunity. However, the injured party may sue an individual state employee for damages, subject to the defense of public employee immunity. The principle of non-delegability discussed in Dykstra does not apply to prevent an injured party from suing a state employee. That's contradictory to previous decisions of this court, but the damage done by that note goes even further than the state, because by logical extension applies to any public employer and makes any public employer or any supervisory personnel of a public employer liable under 32, Chapter Commerce 32, to any private employee or frequenter for a violation of that statute, which was never intended.
What were you reading from?
It's the note after Section 101.11 of the statutes, right at the very end.
Okay, that's their note. Is there something in the Court of Appeals decision that you think is contrary to that, that we have to correct?
This is relying on the Court of Appeals decision, and it's a correct interpretation of the Court of Appeals decision. My point is that it's contrary to law established, longstanding law established by this court, and extends the law significantly, not only to make the state liable to private employees and frequenters under Commerce 32, but to make any public employer and presumably any supervisory personnel, the equivalent of Fox, would be liable to any private employee or frequenter under Commerce 32. There's no indication in the statute or the rule that was ever intended. One last point, since I apparently still have a minute here. In footnote 6 of the Court of Appeals decision, the Court of Appeals stated, quote, on appeal, the plaintiffs are not arguing there is a ministerial duty under the Safe Place statute that is separate from the administrative regulations promulgated pursuant to WSSTATS 101.0553, close quote, making it very clear that the standard that was applied here was the Safe Place standard. The Umanskys argue, I think realizing the problem the Court of Appeals has gotten itself into, argue that, well, it really doesn't apply. We're not really applying. All we're using the standard for is to determine whether the duty is ministerial. But you can't apply a safe place standard to define whether a duty is ministerial and then say, well, that's just a common law duty. It's no longer a common law duty of ordinary care if the standard that's being applied is a safe place standard. And so the Umanskys' argument is inconsistent in that respect. Anyway, for all of those reasons, we believe the Court of Appeals decision should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brinsky. Attorney J. Michael Riley, representing the state.
Thank you, Chief Justice, members of the court. If I might, I'd just like to turn to a couple of the subjects that were already the subject of questioning by the court. And as I went through this and reread the briefs and listened to the arguments, it's one of those cases where it strikes me that the forest has long since been lost in a welter of branches, and I'd like to kind of pull back a little and see if we can take a look at a road out of the woods that we're in here, because I think this is kind of a hyper-technical analysis that ignores some very fundamental facts. First of all, with respect to the questions that were raised by Justice Rubensack and Justice Crook, I mean, there is no cause of action for anybody here under the state's theory. The state says they have no responsibility to a private employee. That employee has no action against his employer because of the workers' compensation exclusive remedy law. The state employee, as I think Justice Rubensack pointed out, also has no remedy against the state. So while the state says, well, we have a responsibility to our employee, there is no remedy for the employee for the wrong. There's a remedy under workers' comp, but that has nothing to do with the fact that the state has violated this person's rights. It just has to do with the fact they've died in the course of their employment.
this is a third, you have the workers' comp death benefits, and then this is a third-party action under 10229.
That's correct, Justice Bradley. There's a suggestion that the rule here is that he analogized this to Chart versus DeVore. Chart's an interesting case here because what Chart specifically says, contrary to what the state asserts, is that supervisory employees may not only may be responsible, but in fact, in Chart, were specifically responsible. And what the court observed there is what's obvious to all of us, and that is that the state can only act through its employees. And so to suggest that the employees have no responsibility is a bit disingenuous because it simply leaves the state without any responsibility at all. I'll talk about that in a little more detail. There's also a suggestion by the state that somehow this is analogous to a stop sign, failing to put up a stop sign. First of all, what I heard the state say is that since he hadn't thought about it and may have been ignorant of it, that he had no responsibility. That is certainly not the law in this state or anywhere, that by failing to know your duties, you somehow are not responsible for discharging them, even though they're clear. It is not at all analogous to the stop sign. What they said in Chart versus Dvorak was that the rules didn't require the stop sign to be put up. Contrary to that case, what we have here is a very clear set of rules laid out under OSHA that mandates the placement of a railing on this, and the state doesn't seriously dispute that OSHA requires that railing be placed.
Counsel, do you agree that Fox has to prevail on there being a ministerial duty that was violated in order for your claim to go forward here?
As I think the court realized from the brief, I would dispute that, but for this part of this argument, I'm certainly arguing that there is a ministerial duty, Justice Reagan said.
Okay. And if there is a ministerial duty, do you agree that it would have to arise under 101.055 of the Wisconsin statutes?
Well, I think it arises under 3215 and 3250, which in turn were authorized by 101.055.
Right, but without 101.055, there wouldn't be those other sections of the administrative code that you speak about, correct?
That's correct, Justice.
Okay, and then my next question is, looking at those sections of the administrative code that you speak of, they talk about a place, and I understood from your brief that one of your countering arguments was that, well, yeah, maybe Mr. Umansky isn't one of the persons that the statute was designed to protect, but the administrative code requires this obligation toward the place that he was working in. Am I understanding your argument correctly?
Perhaps just if I might recast it just
Absolutely.
Slightly.
Absolutely.
You know, what we're saying is this, is that first of all, this is a negligence action. That's what the Court of Appeals found. The Court of Appeals did not find that this was a safe place action. They said it was a negligent action based on violation of a ministerial duty, which is created by 3215 and 3250.
Now, to me, that's an oxymoron, and I have to tell you that, because I look at negligence actions as the obligation to exercise reasonable care under the circumstances. Reasonable care is a discretionary standard all over the place, but a ministerial duty, if it's present, is not discretionary.
And I think that is a key point, Justice. So I think what we're looking at here is the question of whether the duty is ministerial. We start from the premise that this action concedes negligence. I mean, once we bring this action and they raise the immunity defense, discretionary immunity, they have conceded negligence. Negligence also implicates duty. I mean, that's part of what our case law says that repeatedly, that you don't have negligence unless you have duty and a breach of the duty. The question is whether the duty that is breached is ministerial. And that is where you look at the OSHA requirements, which, pursuant to 3215 and 3250, apply to all public buildings and places of employment. Neither of those sections say at any point, nor does 101.055, that these benefits are intended to be limited only to public employees. In fact, what 101.055 says is we're trying to create a standard that is equivalent to the standard that applies to public or to private employees, not a standard that's different from, higher than, set apart from. So I think that's, you know, we believe strongly that this is a negligence action. The breach is a breach of a very specific duty under OSHA. There's no question that his responsibilities included enforcing OSHA regulations, ensuring compliance, and I think that's very clear from the record.
If the administrative sections only spoke of state employees, and there was not a word about buildings in there, would you still have a claim to bring?
I think it would be a different situation if there wasn't a word about buildings, but in fact, those sections do specifically reference all buildings. 3202 in terms of scope says they're to apply to all buildings. 3215 says they're to apply to all public buildings and place of employment. And 3250 specifically imports all of the OSHA regulations.
Okay, so if I understand your answer, you need those buildings in there in order to maintain that there was a ministerial duty that was owed to Mr. Umansky.
I believe that's correct, Justice.
Counsel, can you help me out? What was the OSHA violation of ABC?
I think the ABC's violation was a failure to comply with the same OSHA requirement, the requirement of having a railing. I believe that was the same requirement.
So ABC was responsible for having a railing?
ABC was an employer, so they were responsibility as an, they had a responsibility as an employer. We believe that the state had a responsibility as the owner of the building, which was both a public building and a place of employment. And there's no dispute that the state is subject to the safe place law. What the state really argues is both ways. The state says, well, if it's a general safe place law violation, then we don't have any obligation because those are discretionary. And if it's a specific violation, then we don't have a responsibility because those are only responsibilities to our employees, not to the public at large. So,
how does, I'm sorry, are you finished with your answer? I don't want to interrupt it.
Go ahead, Justice, that's fine.
The idea of duty to the place, I think of, you know, one of the earlier cases that has been around a long time, Cords versus Anderson. Now, that's the known and obvious danger, sort of, at least at the time, it was the known and obvious danger. That's maybe evolved a bit under Lodal. But when I think of that case, I think of, you know, it involved a place, you know, it involved the park, but I never thought of it as, it was the duty to exercise ordinary care for the safety of the frequenters or those who were there. So I don't know how you tie it to place. Explain that to me in this immunity analysis, whether it be, as we used to say, just the known and obvious danger, or whether known and obvious danger now has become ministerial and blended, I don't know. But how does that really play out? I never thought of it in terms of...
Seating at the outset, this was a known and present danger case. If we applied the same logic to that case, what Mr. Glinski would be arguing is that if a park ranger fell over, that the state would be liable, but that if, you know, the people who did fall over, the two hikers, then the state would have no liability. I grant you there's a difference in the cases, but that's the nature of that argument. But, you know, this is a different case because the standard that we're using is an OSHA standard, and this standard is very expressed. There was no explicit standard there. What the court was dealing with there wasn't a duty that was ministerial in the sense that a statute or some regulation created a specific set of duties that had to be complied with. What the court said there is that the very nature of the danger, the nature of the hazard was so dramatic that there was a ministerial duty to address that danger. What I think is interesting particularly about that is that, again, it was a supervisory employee who was held responsible just as in Chart 3 Dvorak. So the notion that the state cannot delegate is not a notion that's supported by the case law or I believe, by logic. If I can just briefly turn to that, the state argues that they can't delegate and therefore they can't be, Mr. Fox shouldn't be held responsible. That just ignores the reality of the situation. The state can only act through its employees. The state cannot be sued. Employees can be sued under 89382. Employees will be indemnified under 895.46. Both Chart v. Dvorak, Cords v. Anderson, and Bicknase v. Sutila are all cases where, in fact, the state employee was subject to the suit, and they said, this is within your job description, and if there is a specific responsibility, the state, in fact, can be found responsible. If you go back to Holitz, and many other cases besides Holitz, the state certainly has respondeat superior. It's, in effect, enshrined in statute in 895.46. So to suggest that somehow the state can't delegate is not consistent with the case law, is not consistent with the statutory scheme, and would effectively mean that the state would be totally immunized since they can only act through their employees. What the cases say, and there are a number of cases cited, some are workers' comp cases that really aren't relevant because what they deal with is trying to get around the exclusivity remedy. But the cases that are cited, Dykstra, for instance, which they cite, what Dykstra says specifically is, under any circumstances, it is the owner or employer who must answer, which is precisely what would happen here based on our statutory scheme. I think their interpretation, frankly, would lead to an absurdity and would just disregard that scheme entirely. Then the argument that really seems to be at the heart of what they're saying now is that the state has no obligation to the public under the Safe Place Law. And again, they argue, well, if it's a general Safe Place Law rule, then it's discretionary. If it's OSHA, it's only the employee. I think the example raised by Justice Crooks early on is instructive. I mean, that says then that if we have two people, one employee, one not an employee, and with this facing exactly the same hazard, then, you know, the employee, barring the workers' comp, recovers, the non-employee doesn't. It just doesn't pass the smell test. It's very difficult to believe that enacting all these regulations, 101.055 and the 3215 and 3250, that the intent of the legislature was to say, it's perfectly all right for the state to create hazards and injure private parties, but they'll be held answerable if they injure their own employees. I just don't believe that that is a reasonable interpretation of the statutory scheme. And the language, when you look at it, the 3202 says this applies to all places of employment in public buildings. It doesn't say only for the benefit of public employees. 3215 says all places of employment and public buildings shall comply with OSHA. Again, it doesn't say only for the benefit of public employees. There are fundamental concerns for safety, and the notion that the state could have no liability to a frequenter, I simply think is inconsistent with those and inconsistent with the likely legislative intent. In order to reach the conclusion that the state urges, you really have to believe that the legislature was going to draw that sort of distinction and say, if you want to take the top railings off the upper deck at Camp Randall and a bunch of people fall over, you're not going to be held responsible, but if, you know, one of the peanut vendors for the state goes over, then you will be responsible. It just defies logic that that was the intent, and I don't believe the language supports that, and there is no case that the state has cited that takes that position.
Mr. Riley, this is in response to the state's first argument relating to particular employees, state employees versus everyone else, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Number two, I'd like you to move, if you would, to the state's argument about ministerial. And in your discussion, I'd appreciate your telling us if there's anything about the Court of Appeals decision that you think needs correction. This is a very long opinion, and a lot of ground is covered in it.
It is, Jess. I probably squandered far too much time to address it in detail, but let me address the basic question. I don't think there's any question that the duty is ministerial. The question about whether a duty is ministerial has to do, whether it's absolute, certain, imperative, and the rest of the things that Justice Bradley already recited.
Right, well, and that's in paragraph 18 of the Court of Appeals decision.
It is, and if you look at, if in fact, as we believe, the OSHA requirement applies, that OSHA requirement, which is contained in detail in our brief, is highly detailed. It sets forth a mandatory requirement. It says shall have railings. There is no indication that there is any time for which you cannot have a railing. So the notion that the timeliness argument or the uncertainty as to time that the state raises really is no more than a red herring. And that would be suggesting that you only have to comply with stop signs, you know, at certain times of day or when there isn't any traffic. I mean, this is a law. I mean, this law says unequivocally you have to comply with OSHA, 3215. OSHA says unequivocally this platform must have a railing. Not that it might or that you should think about it or, you know, it says it must have it. And so I think that that language is peremptory and absolute, and the detail is far more certain than what we find in many cases. If you look at Sudala versus Bicknace Orchard v. Dvorak, where this court applied the statute saying that the city of Milwaukee had to enact certain rules containing certain provisions. I mean, what we have here is a far more explicit rule than in any of those cases. So, you know, I really think that in terms of ministerial duty, there's no question. I think the real issue that they seem to be raising is that, well, okay, that may be ministerial, but somehow it doesn't apply under these circumstances. And I think that's the discussion we've just had about the nature of the rules importing the OSHA requirements into state law. And I believe that the law really is clear that we should have that. I think public policy is far better served by a law that encourages safety by saying, when you have to comply with OSHA rules, you have to comply with those rules, and you can't be heard later to argue that who the person who was injured in the end determines whether or not your non-compliance is acceptable or whether or not that somehow becomes non-ministerial.
Well, Mr. Riley, how does that comport with the legislative intent as expressed in Section 101.055, where it talks about public employees and state employees?
Well, I think that's a good question, Justin. I think it does comport in this sense. I mean, when you heard, I think Justice Cook's question was an apt one, because you say, well, what if there's a public employee and a non-public employee? I think that the key is that you create these duties, and obviously the duties are going to benefit public employees, but they also benefit non-public employees. If there is no consequence, which is what the state is arguing, for the violation of these very explicit duties, then certainly the public employment is rendered far less safe, just as it's rendered less safe for those who are frequenters on the property. And to me, that would be a significant part of the answer. Thank you, Justice.
Counsel, if I may, I just want to ask you, there, as I hear you, ABC had a responsibility because they were found responsible under OSHA, right?
They're an employee, that's correct, Justice.
They were responsible for putting the safety precautions up on the platform.
I don't believe that's quite correct, Justice. I think they're responsible for ensuring that their employee is not working in a place that doesn't have those. I mean, the responsibility for erecting that was with the university, and Mr. Fox didn't dispute that in his deposition. He said that he was the one. In fact, what to me is a significant factual thing is they didn't just not erect the railing. They took the railing down. The railing was up. It was taken down. It was taken down, with Mr. Fox, and Mr. Fox was aware of that. He says that in his deposition. So what we had here was not just a situation where they didn't comply, but a situation where they had complied and then actually took this down and created the hazard.
I'm trying to figure out what ABC's responsibility was, if anything, with respect to the OSHA regulations.
Sure. ABC's responsibility, Justice, is strictly as an employer. So as an employer, you know, what I think OSHA would say and probably did say is you can't allow your employee to go work in an unsafe place. You may not own that place, as they didn't own Camp Randall, so you may not be able to build the railing. They had no right to do that. But you can't let your employee work in that place if it doesn't comply with OSHA requirements.
How would this case be any different if it were in the Packers Stadium instead of Camp Randall?
Well, it would be very different, I think, because it's clearly a public building. It would clearly be subject to the OSHA requirements, and there wouldn't be this argument concerning discretionary immunity, which is what the state is relying on, Justice. So, yes, I believe you're correct. It would be a very different case.
Why is it so clear that 3215 and 3250 apply by referring back to or arising out of 101055 when 101055 deals with public employees' safety and health?
What it says is you can enact rules consistent with this, and 3250 says we can import these rules because of 101.055, and then the rules are imported specifically in 3215.
But isn't that, I mean, that's a question that we're addressing here, whether 101.055, which deals just with public employees' safety and health, whether or not that is the conduit through which private employees can be protected under 3215 and 3250. Why isn't that a question for seven members of the Supreme Court to decide? And if it is, then how can it be said to be so clear, certain, an imperative?
Absolute.
An absolute, thanks.
Well, That's a different question. The rule that's being imported is the OSHA reg. That is clear and definite and certain. The state doesn't really dispute that, and I don't think it can be disputed. Now the question is, what's the effect of 101.055? Essentially, Justice, what I believe the argument is this, is that when we have that situation, we have, first of all, conceded negligence. We have a breach of duty, because that's part of negligence. The question is the nature of that duty. And what I'm arguing, Justice, and what I believe the law supports, is that that duty is set forth clearly in 3215, which imports the OSHA regulations, which are highly specific.
The duty, it exists. I mean, that may be specific, but isn't the question that we're wrestling with in the case, I mean, whether or not the duty set forth in that rule is applicable through the conduit of 101.055?
Well, I think that duty is clearly applicable through the conduit of 101.055, and I don't think the state disputes that. What the state is saying is that duty runs only to state employees.
Yes, that's what I mean. 101.055 deals with the health and safety of public employees.
Because, first of all, I think if you read the language of 3215, 3250, and 3202, they are very broad. They do not limit the application simply to state employees. Secondly, and I think perhaps more importantly, the question is whether he has the duty. I don't think there's any dispute that there is a duty unless you agree with their non-delegation argument, which I don't believe is supportable. I think if you take that aside, then it's clear Fox has this duty. And what they're doing, which is contrary to what we do in virtually any other case, is suggesting, well, we can somehow limit that duty and say that this, we can't look at this ministerial act as defining his duty. That's a separate question from the fact that you're bringing an action to negligence. His defense to that action is, well, I have discretionary immunity. What we are saying is he does not have discretion to ignore that regulation. And I believe it's clear that he does not.
Counselor, I think he's also saying something else. I think he's saying if there's any ministerial duty here, it was not owed to Mr. Umansky. And I don't know how he has conceded negligence and a breach of a duty. I frankly haven't seen that anywhere, so you're going to have to point me in that direction, because if he's conceded the breach of a duty and the duty is the OSHA duty, I don't know what we're all doing here, right? That's the end of the case. So you have to point me to where has he conceded that he breached the duty.
You'll recall I didn't ask to be here, Justice.
Well put.
Thank you. I think that there are a number of cases, Justice, that say that when you employ the defense of discretionary immunity, you're conceding at the outset that there is negligence. Like the cases say it assumes negligence. It assumes negligence has occurred, and the argument is this really is an affirmative defense. It's saying, yes, there may be a breach of duty. We're leaving that aside because, of course, we're at summary judgment, and we haven't had development of facts. But what we're saying, what they're saying is that given the fact that we have committed a breach of duty, which is negligence, we believe that there is no duty to this particular person. I agree with you that that's really the heart of their argument. What I am saying is that our case law traditionally has not limited duty in that fashion and said that your duty only runs to, or that if you violate the duty that someone and someone else is injured, that doesn't mean that you're excused from that violation of duty. The question here is what sets the bounds of the ministerial duty here? That's the OSHA regulation. It's clear, it's unequivocal, and it sets those requirements. I don't think that leaving aside the argument about not delegating, I don't think the state disputes that if this were a public employee, if we didn't have workers' comp exclusivity, that they would be liable to that public employee for this breach.
Well, I think what they're saying is that they owed this obligation to public employees, but they didn't owe it to a public place. And I think you and I had that discussion early on when you said, well, yeah, they do, because the administrative regulations say a public place. And counsel on the other side say, well, no, the statute doesn't include frequenters, which is essentially what you're doing by focusing on a duty to a place rather than a duty to a person. Isn't that correct?
I don't think so, Justice. Let me just say this respectfully. First of all, I think that 3215 and 3215 and 3202 both refer specifically to places. They talk about places
in
public places. They don't limit the scope of that. Justice, if I might, I understand we briefed this, but I would like, if I might, to turn just generally to the doctrine. I'd take a couple minutes to discuss that quickly. First of all, with respect to the whole doctrine of discretionary immunity, the discussion we just had to me is illustrative of the problems with the doctrine. We start getting into these hyper-technical distinctions, which Holitz was highly critical of, which is the reason that Holitz abrogated governmental immunity. And from a public policy standpoint, the primary responsibility of government, the first and most important, is to protect its citizens. To suggest that we now have a doctrine that effectively protects the government from its citizens, insulates the government from responsibility for acts which cause injury, to me, it's just contrary to the most fundamental tenets of our public policy. You know, Holitz clearly set forth that the rule was supposed to be liability and that then the exception would be immunity. 893-80 adopted Holitz virtually intact, with the exception of legislative and judicial, quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial. 893-82, interestingly, doesn't even have those exceptions, doesn't contain those specific exceptions, the legislative, judicial, quasi-legislative, and quasi-judicial. And we've gotten where we are really because of two cases, Lister and Leifert. The Lister case said, first of all, they're both terrible trial situations, university law students suing the state, you know, that's not the most sympathetic situation. But leaving that aside, so look at the statutory scheme, 893-80, 893-82, 895-46, which provides indemnity. These are claim statutes. The courts have said now, a number of our courts of appeals have said, these are immunity statutes. They're not immunity statutes. You can't reasonably read the plain language of the statutes that way. You can find limited immunity in 893-80, nothing about immunity in 893-82. Lister came down after Holitz, ignored Holitz, said two things. It's based on broad public policy considerations, and each case ought to be a weighing of those considerations against the rights of the injured party. First of all, the public policy considerations, and we've briefed this and I won't belabor it, none of those public policy considerations have any meaning in the current day. We have indemnity under 895-46. The state under respondeat superior, which Holitz envisioned and which is certainly embodied in 895-46, picks up any claim against the state employee. So there is no personal liability for state employees, which virtually all of those considerations implicate. If you go through the cases since then, and you look at those cases in detail, you will not find a single case where there is any effort to weigh these considerations, the competing considerations of protecting the public, and indemnifying or compensating those who are injured, and the concerns raised by the specific public policy concerns raised in the Lister decision. It is simply time, I believe, for the court to come back to that and address that and to look at it in a meaningful fashion. This doctrine has grown like Topsy, has obviously started as an exception, quickly absorbed the rule. We've now reached a point where if we adopt the arguments suggested by the state here, it is difficult to conceive under what circumstance the state is going to have liability. Clearly, they would have no liability under any circumstance for the violation of an explicit OSHA rule. I do not believe that can be considered to be consistent with the public policy of our state. I do not believe it can be considered to be consistent with the legislative intent expressed in 893-80, 893-82, and 895-46.
Could I ask one question?
Yes, Justice.
Or a couple questions. Would OSHA apply by itself to State Capitol or Camp Randall or public buildings in Wisconsin?
Yes, it does, Justice.
Directly?
Directly.
Then why is it that the statute is necessary?
Well, the reason it's necessary is to provide the certainty and the explicitness, the peremptory certain as the date, time, place, all the rest of it. That's why it's necessary. If we take away discretionary immunity, it's not necessary at all. The state has conceded that the safe place law applies to Camp Randall. It's a public building. The safe place law was, in fact, amended some years ago to add the state and municipalities and to make it clear that they are subject to the safe place law. So the question isn't whether they're subject to it. The state would... May I continue?
Yes.
Thank you. There's no question that the state is subject to the safe place law. What they argue is that, but the general safe place law is discretionary, and compliance with that is discretionary, and therefore, under discretionary immunity, even though they may have violated the safe place law, they're okay. Under the OSHA requirements are specifically imported under 3215, and that's the nature of their argument, is that somehow that has to therefore be limited to state employees. But there is no reason There's no reason in my mind at all for that distinction. I don't think, again, it's consistent with the general statutory scheme, with the notion that the state is subject to the safe place law. We've said that, but we've then, what the state would like is to be rendered totally immune from any responsibility under that law. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you, Mr. Riley. Mr. Grinsky?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's hard to know where to start. Let me say this much. I would be more inclined to agree with Mr. Riley if 101.055 read public employee and frequenter, safety and health. And the intent was that it's the intent of this section to give employees of the state and frequenters protection. Or in 3, it said the department shall adopt by administrative rule standards to protect the safety and health of public employees and frequenters. But it doesn't say that. 101.11 says that, but not 101.055. The cases that Mr. Riley cited, Cords, Chart, Bickney's, they're relevant because they're not safe place cases. When we're talking about the safe place statutes, we're talking about a public policy decision to impose a higher standard of care on employers to their employees or other people in the workplace with permission, such as subcontractors, i.e. the frequenters. What the Umanskys want to do is take that higher standard and impose it on someone other than the employer, allow the employer to delegate it to someone else, and then impose liability on that someone else, generally an employee, for violating that higher standard, which was intended only to be imposed on the employer. The ministerial duty question, at least the discussion of it, again ignores the fact that you first have to determine whether 3215 and 3250 apply, and that is a discretionary decision, especially under these facts. And I think the conclusion that has to be reached is it doesn't even apply. But even if you found that it did apply, the job description is more to me like a job description in KIMPS. It's a general job description. To say that someone's job description is to comply with all applicable safety codes and regulations doesn't indicate how they're supposed to go about that, when. There are hundreds of safety codes. There are hundreds of OSHA regulations. There isn't any person in the world probably who is knowledgeable with respect to all of those and would know which ones apply when, under what circumstances, depending on who's occupying the place and so forth. To say that that imposes a ministerial duty is to take a general job description of saying basically comply with all applicable safety codes and then make it ministerial whenever you come to a situation involving any one of those regulations. To me, it's much more similar to KIMPS with its general job description, which is held to be discretionary in Canton Post.
Counselor, I want to ask you a question that I asked opposing counsel, and his response was that there is a violation of a ministerial duty that Mr. Umanski can sue on because there was a duty owed by Mr. Fox to the place itself. And since he was in that place, he can benefit by the violation of that duty. And he relies on the administrative code, which mentions places, but the statute itself does not mention places. What's your take on the relationship of that statement in the administrative code as compared with 101.055?
Well, my response would be that 101.11 also applies to all places of employment in public buildings, but the legislature specifically indicated who had rights under that statute and who had obligations. The employer has obligations to his or her employees and frequenters. So when the legislature wanted to include someone other than the employer's employees, it specifically stated that. This is taking a duty that's designed to impose a higher standard of care on a public employer and making that public employer and his employees responsible to the public at large. I mean, there's really nothing in the statute that justifies that kind of an extension. Besides, that kind of a reasoning actually is contrary to Berry versus Ameritech, which I think is somewhat an analogous case. Berry slipped on some stairs and hurt himself in a building owned by Ameritech. Sued Ameritech under the Safe Play statute. Ameritech sued, let's see, who was it? There was a contractor. Bergmeier, for contribution. And what this court held was that in the verdict, Bergmeier should be included, but any negligence against Bergmeier should be imputed to Ameritech as the owner, because that duty couldn't be delegated. But more importantly, what this court held was that in determining the negligence of Bergmeier, the standard should be that should be used is ordinary care under the common law, not the higher standard under 101.11, because that was applicable only to Ameritech as the owner of the building. So what the Umanskys argue in this case is directly contrary to what this court held in Berry versus Ameritech, namely that the higher standard applies only to the employer, and if you're going to talk about the employee's duty, it has to be under the common law, ordinary care, 101.11 of the statutes, which is has been held to be discretionary because it involves making a place reasonably safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glinski, and thank you, Mr. Riley, for your arguments in another immunity case, of which we've had several in recent years. That concludes our argument in 07AP385, Glinski versus ABC Insurance Company. The students should remain in the courtroom, and Justice Crooks will be out momentarily to talk with you about the procedures of the court. Anyone else who wishes to stay and listen, you're all welcome. We are in recess till 1:30.